Apologies for the ads. As an independent one-woman show, ads help me recover some of my costs. If you want to skip the ads, sign up to the exclusive feed. All episodes are free from ads, and there's full-length bonus episodes as well. The link is in the show notes. You can also make a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/amillionOTW. And on with the show, as they say.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is A Million Other Choices, and I am your host, Kim. Hey, did you know that Google Podcasts is disappearing? I'm not exactly sure when it's going to happen, but they think sometime in April, and they're going to do it with like very little notice or any fanfare around it. So if you're listening on Google, I don't know, pause, get off, go download another app so that you don't miss out on any of your favorite shows. Obviously, if you're an Apple user, you can stay on Apple. Spotify is still available. But Android users who are using Google, you can move over to Pocket Cast or Podcast Addict, and I'm on those as well as Amazon. Most of your favorite shows are still going to be available on any of the other apps. It sounds like they're notifying the podcasters, but not so much the podcast listeners, which doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. So if you go and listen to a podcast and then the app has suddenly disappeared, you'll know why that is. Well, I don't actually know why it is. I just know that it's happening. But Google is actually my fifth most popular app used by listeners, and I do not want to lose you guys, and you probably don't want to stop listening to podcasts in general, so I guess we all have to make the switch. Anyways, the case that I have for you today is from Calgary, and normally Calgary cases don't get a lot of podcast or YouTube coverage, but this one did actually get a little bit. I haven't watched or listened to any of it, so if you hear something different today that you've heard before, well, I did take the court documents, which are available online, so I feel pretty confident that I have the right information on this case. But I noticed that the news coverage left out some stuff. So today I'm going to try and fill you in on everything that I was able to find out. And the reason I think that it was left out was to protect the character of the victim, which I am super about. I don't think that anyone deserves to be murdered regardless of their financial, social, or lifestyle choices. I actually don't even personally feel that sex offenders and other murderers deserve it. I just maybe don't care very much when it happens to them is all. But in this case, I really do care. So I did consider leaving it out as well because, as you know, I don't really like anything that's victim blaming. And in this case, it's not even really victim blaming. It's just anything that would kind of muddy the memory of someone. But I'm also a very strong believer in trying to use this platform as a way of furthering the message that no one deserves to be murdered. And quite frankly, news reporters around here will shield you from information regarding white female victims, but not all victims get the same treatment. Let's just kind of leave it there. And anyways, how can I further a message if I leave the information out? Do some women trade sex for money? Yes. Do they deserve to be murdered? No. It's why I've been always very honest about my coverage of Taylor. She used drugs, recreational. She didn't make great choices when it came to men, but she didn't deserve what happened to her, and we didn't deserve to have her taken from us. But today's story is a warning for all of us. This is the disappearance and murder of Lisa Mitchell. I don't know much about Lisa's early years. I know that she was born the youngest of two sisters to her mom, Peggy. There's no word on her dad, but in interviews, Peggy mentioned briefly that they were divorced and then she was with her second husband, Jay. but I don't know the timelines of any of that history there. But what I can tell you about Lisa is that she was an incredible artist. She started drawing at about the age of 4, and by a young adult, her sketches showed a very incredible talent. She chose mainly animation-like manga type of stuff, but her sketches of faces and animals were really amazing, just a really good eye for detail. She also loved music and started a girl group with her girlfriends called Just Cause. Now, I'm sure she's mortified right now that I've included that little detail, but I think it just shows her spunk and confidence and outgoingness, like just that willingness at a young age when we're all kinds of awkward to just put herself out there. In other school subjects, she was a more average student, so she opted not to go to college or university, and she started working the regular type of after school or after high school jobs, grocery clerk, coffee shops, etc. Although she did work for a time selling snow cones at events, so she got to meet Nickelback once. And all of the other coverage out there mentions that part, so I'm going to too, because it was a real highlight for her and something that she talked about a lot, so it was obviously a really big deal for her. And that kind of work was great for Lisa because she got to meet all kinds of people, which she loved to do, and of course she enjoyed the music. And it must not have been too long after high school that she went to a restaurant with a friend one night and met the charming but shy and introverted sous chef, Alan Scheibach. Peggy says that she wasn't really a fan of Alan from the start, and the reason that she gives is that Lisa's outgoing nature and his more introverted one, she felt that there might be issues. And personally, I don't really think that that was really the reason. In reality, Lisa brought out the worst in Alan, and Alan brought out the worst in Lisa, and together they were toxic, although very passionate. The story, as old as time, passion is a strong emotion, and it runs either hot or cold. There's really no warmth to it. So over the next 10 years, they ran either hot or cold, and when things were cold, there was violence between them. And sometimes Lisa was the aggressor, and sometimes it was Alan. And during those 10 years together between 1992 and 2012, they had two kids together, first a boy and then a girl. And this is why I have left this stuff in about Lisa's life. We can be lovely and wonderful and kind and gentle souls, but there are certain people that can make us toxic and changes how we behave. And I strongly believe that Alan was that for Lisa. So about 5 years in, they actually broke up. Alan moved out, and then Lisa moved in with her mom, and she started the process of getting over him. But he came back, and he wanted to work things out and had bought an engagement ring for her. So she went back to him, and they got married, but the troubles continued. So now I have to go a little off track from the usual coverage and refer to the court documents. And part of the reason they were on again, off again, was that there was infidelity, probably on both sides, although this story becomes told very sort of one-sided, as we're going to see, but on Lisa's side. And this became part of their circle. So there was this indiscretion. They fought and they broke up. They would try to get back together. He would bring it all up again and was get controlling and put recording software on her phone. They would usually fight about old stuff, break up, usually with violence on either side, sparking the separation, and the circle would continue. And to be fair to Lisa, the court documents make it sound like it was outright cheating that she had done, but it sounds like a little bit more like the they were on a break thing to me. Bringing up old stuff from back before they were married, couples love to rehash old crap. After they got married and the kids came along, there was new stuff to fight about as well. Alan worked as a cook or a mechanic, but he didn't always hold down steady work. And Lisa would take care of the kids during the day, and then she worked at nights. And when Alan got home, they were supposed to trade places. But Alan was tired or just not really interested in domestic stuff, and so she would get frustrated by the overload of work on her plate, and Alan would get frustrated that Lisa didn't have time for him, and blah, 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 blah. And during these times, there were a couple of incidents that I just can't paint in any other way than that Lisa could be quite violent towards Alan. At one point, she actually hit him in the head with a frying pan. And this particular evening, so that would have been sometime in April around 2012, when the boys were 3 and 5 years old, that argument led Lisa to hitting Alan with a metal frying pan. And he had tried to call the police, but Lisa pulled the phone out of the wall. So he left and went out to his truck and called from his cell phone. And when the police came, they gave them three options. Either he leaves, she leaves, and I don't actually know what the third option was, but it wasn't taken. So Alan decided to move into his truck for a couple of nights, but he did apply for an emergency protection order the next day, but it was denied. Now, he was either denied because back in 2012, they didn't believe men when it came to domestic violence, or perhaps they felt that he had exaggerated some of it. I actually have no idea. But what did happen after that night, because it had happened when the kids were there, is that the kids were put into foster care. They had already been under some kind of supervision order, but I can't comment on what exactly that was about or how it worked because the kids were still living there at the time. And as you can imagine, losing their kids over their fighting sent the couple spiraling even further. And by the time that summer of 2012 rolled around, they were pretty much living separate lives. Lisa spent only about 2 nights a week at home. And the other nights she was either at her mom's or with a new boyfriend because she really was trying to move on. And Lisa was very conflicted at this time about her relationship with Alan. So on one hand, she's trying to move on, start this new life. But on the other hand, she had it in her mind that staying with Alan and working on things was the best way to get her kids back. Which isn't actually true. Moving on is probably the better option for that, but she didn't know that. And during these months, Peggy wasn't exactly telling Lisa to go work on her marriage, and I really don't blame her one bit for that. As a mom myself, I'd be doing everything I could to keep those two away from each other. So Lisa took a job at her mom's suggestion in Longview, which is a bit of a drive. It's about an hour or so out of town, waitressing at the same place that she worked, which was the Twin Cities Hotel Tavern. And this way they could spend some more time together. And Lisa had a place to stay when she didn't want to go home, which was probably fairly frequently at that point. And her mom told her that she could stay anytime with them, but Alan had actually moved them into a new townhouse in Ogden in Calgary and was telling her that this was going to be their new start. So Lisa is just all kinds of confused and conflicted at this time. And so on the night of October 27th, 2012, which was a Saturday, her work hosted a Halloween party, and Peggy and Lisa danced and partied the night away, let off some much-needed steam, and Lisa stayed in Longview that night with her mom. The next day they got up and they were just kind of hanging out, and then Lisa got into her truck and drove back to Calgary right around 1 p.m. Peggy left her a couple of voicemails and sent a couple of texts over the next 2 days that went unanswered, and Peggy was starting to get concerned. So she hopped in her car and she drove to their place in Ogden, where Alan said that she had come home on the Sunday and that on the Monday they had argued again. He went out to cool off and get cigarettes, and when he came back, she was gone. And Peggy's like, well, why are her shoes and her coat still here? And he's like, I have no idea, she isn't here. You can come in and look if you want. And you bet your bottom dollar she did go in and look. But there was no signs of anything amiss other than the normal coat and shoes that she usually wore were left there, like the ones that she would wear the most often, and a few personal belongings, but she didn't see her purse. But Peggy just didn't like it. But Alan's saying, look, I don't know what to tell you. She sent me an email, and then she took off to get away for a while, and like, I believe her. So without finding Lisa, Peggy went home and she checked her emails as well. And thankfully, Lisa had sent an email before she left, just saying that she had to get away, love you, we'll be in touch. So that kind of relieved her worry for about a day, but they continued to email back and forth. And Peggy wanting to know more about sort of what was going on and why she had left like that, but her emails just didn't really give her enough information to keep those nagging thoughts and worries away. And then one morning she woke up to a voicemail from Lisa saying, hey, I'm okay. Sometimes my weeks get crazy, you know, and it was quiet for a while. And then all of a sudden this happened. And within a half a day I should, but he's back now. I got to go. Love you. And it was definitely Lisa's voice, but so strange. Like it didn't really make sense. Like she was kind of talking, but all over the place and about, I got to go. He's back made her really worry that maybe she didn't leave of her own free will and was being held somewhere. So Peggy called the police and reported her missing. And when you report an adult missing, the thing is, it seems to depend on the officer that gets the report. Because how many times have we heard, oh, she's probably off on a bender, she'll show up, and nothing is done about it. And then other times they go knock on the door and ask a neighbor if they've seen her, and that's about it. Unless, of course, they suspect foul play. But in this case, they didn't actually suspect anything was really amiss other than that she took off. And I know right away you're thinking Alan killed her. And they did go to the house in Ogden and did a search. Alan was cooperative and very honest. He told them that, yeah, their relationship was troubled and there was violence. And I guess she finally had just had enough, and I really don't blame her for up and leaving. Although he was sad that she had finally left him for good, but there really wasn't anything to point to her being gone, as in deceased. The emails looked legit and alluded that she had moved away from Calgary, but didn't want to say where she was. And the voicemail was a little bit odd, but it was her voice. They also checked her bank records for footprints of life, though, and they were coming up with nothing. So it was strange that she would be communicating with family, but not using any money or didn't clear out her bank account before she left. Constable Carl Sudik was the missing person's lead detective, and he was working actually pretty hard on trying to track her down. You are allowed to go missing, but you can still be tracked down because the family just wants to know that you're alive. And remember, Lisa was also dating during the weeks before her disappearance. She had a dating profile, and this just kind of made finding her a little bit more difficult. And Constable Sudik asked Homicide Detective Dave Sweet to interview Alan just to get a feel for him, because he was the last confirmed person to have seen Lisa. And Dave found Alan to be honest and just kind of sad and beaten down by the whole thing, that his wife had finally left for good. And as we know, Dave's used to dealing with all kinds of guys that go for a walk and then find their wives or girlfriends missing or dead. And Dave's assessment was that he was being honest. He wasn't trying to make the relationship sound better than it was. And he told him that he thought that they were going to try and work things out to get the kids back. But I guess she just decided not to.
It seemed like progress was being made. Like we both did want the same thing. Now I have to look back at it and go, okay, well, you left. You just up and left.
But then there was a little change in the law regarding missing persons. Now, I couldn't find exactly when the law change was passed. It was likely sometime in 2013 somewhere. But before that, police couldn't pull your phone or health records or anything personal like that, except I think maybe banking records. But there had to be suspicion of a crime for that even. So the law was changed that police can now apply to a justice of the peace for permission to pull records on a missing person. Now, you are either going to be of two camps on this. Either it's great, you think they need access to the stuff to find missing persons, or you think it's a huge invasion of privacy, especially when there's no evidence of a crime. And going missing in itself is not a crime. So I guess how you feel about it just sort of depends on why you've gone missing. If I'm dead, you can have all the access you want and try to find my killer. If I'm not dead and just trying to get some peace and quiet, maybe not. But anyways, they pulled her phone records. And at first, it just kind of created more work because she had been talking to a number of different people around that time, including having an open online dating profile. But they were able to find the records on the phone that had left the voicemail, and it turned out to be a burner phone that had been purchased in Calgary but was registered in Edmonton. And on the 14th of November, the phone made four calls to Alan, starting at 9:06 p.m. and then just kind of like 1 minute apart. And the last one at 9:17, and then one call to Peggy on the 15th of November at 2:44 a.m., which was the voicemail. But what was a little strange about this was that Alan had said that other than the email that he had gotten, he never heard from her after she left. Well, November 14th was a good 2 weeks after she had left, and where did this call to Peggy's voicemail ping to? Well, that was just outside Lisa and Alan's house in Ogden. So with that little tidbit of information, they could get a warrant for Alan's phone and bank records as well, because they were starting to think that maybe he did have something to hide here about her disappearance. All right, you guys knew all along that he did something, but let me finish the story. So in the days after Lisa disappeared, Alan did some shopping. A large plastic Rubbermaid container, cat litter without owning a cat, bleach, disposable gloves, cement, and a mixing bucket, and plywood. All things that make a detective go, Oh, and he took out $40 in cash, and the burner phone purchased $39.99, coincidentally.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And when interviewed for Crime Beat, Constable Sudik said that he actually went out and bought all of the items and brought them into the homicide detectives and said, "What do you think?" And they said, "That's a burial kit." Sudik thought so too. So while Alan was just going about his normal business, and I believe he had gotten the kids back into his care by this time, the police snuck into his house, legally of course, and took a look around. And in the basement they found all the items that he had purchased. But there were boxes now sitting on this weird cement. It was almost like a cement bench or something that was built into a corner in the basement. And it just looked weird. But they left everything as it was because they didn't want Alan to know that they were looking into him. And instead, they thought a confession would be a much more airtight case. Once again, enter Mr. Big. Now, I'm not going to go into huge details about the sting itself, even though I know some of you are fascinated by these ruses. It was dubbed Operation Aurora, but it wasn't your usual Mr. Big. Usually involves befriending the suspect and then drawing them into this illegal crime syndicate. But Alan wasn't a criminal. At least not that they knew of. So he wasn't going to fall into anything that he knew was illegal. But what Alan could use was a friend. So they found a way to make buddies with him and take him on this trip to Winnipeg, like a boys trip. And while he's there, he gets a call from our own Detective Dave Sweet, who tells him, "We have reason to believe this is now a homicide, and we've gotten a tip on it, so we're going to go search your house again, just FYI." And with that panic in his heart, he unloaded to his friend what had happened, a.k.a. he confessed.
"I just recently got contacted by a homicide detective. I basically have to get and completely lose who I am, who the kids are, and start over. But they do search the house. The reality is, they are going to arrest me." We realized us fighting separately wasn't getting us anywhere. We tried to reconcile. We've been living together again for a few months. And of course, you know, it was good for a little bit.
Yeah, she was just in a bad mood that whole day, and then they kind of just go to bed, but tomorrow's another day, and then right from the get, I think as we kind of argued through that night, eventually just said the hell of it, went to sleep. I just slept on the couch. And first thing, the next day, it was like just right back into it, and it just kind of kept going, going, going. I don't even remember what the real fight was all about. I don't even remember. All I remember is that we were just arguing. It was just back and forth. Yeah, the whole day, and I can't even think of what it was. I don't know what we were saying to each other. I don't know what was making everything so heated.
She kind of came towards me with the knife. I don't know if she, at the time I thought she was trying to stab me. I don't know now. Things happened. I wound up trying to hold her back, hold her down. My hands wound up around her neck. I choked. I can remember sitting there trying to let go and not being able to. So I wound up hiding the body. And pushing some text messages and emails from her to the family and stuff, saying that she left. She got hold of her cell phone, like to Walmart kind of thing, one of those prepaid, got it activated to an Edmonton number. And that's what I used to call her mom and leave the voice. And I just played a recording from the computer through the phone, or the speaker basically. It said, hi, mom. Sorry. I just got kind of a way on me. Oh, he's coming back now. I gotta go. Because I accessed her email accounts and stuff from there, and I created the phone call from the computer. But I had some clips of her voice. I patched those together and sent her mom a voicemail with her voice on it to try and help make sure that it seemed like she was gone and try and give some sort of life back to her.
And I cleaned that place top to bottom with bleach and stuff two or three times afterwards, just to be sure.
And just to give you a little bit more of what he described as happened, I'm just going to read this from the court documents instead of trying to paraphrase it all. The accused described an altercation on October 28, 2012, when the couple started arguing, which fell into a pattern of rehashing all their issues. The argument continued into the night. The couple slept separately. In the morning of October 29th, the argument recommenced. He described being in the corner of the kitchen by the stove when Lisa Mitchell picked up a chef's knife on the table and told him she could stab him, tell the police it was self-defense, he would be in jail, she would have the children, and he would not see them again. He believed her and thought that she would hurt him. She was holding the knife by the handle, blade vertical to the floor, and then she raised the knife up over her shoulder, now horizontal to the floor and facing him. He reacted, lifting his left arm to shield himself from the knife and putting his right hand at her neck, closing it around her neck and squeezing to push her back. The couple was in close quarters in a small kitchen area. The couple fell to the floor. Lisa Mitchell was on her back. The accused was on top of her with his left leg. One of her arms was underneath him and his right hand remained on her neck. His left hand moved to the upper shoulder or neck area. Time seemed to slow down. When they were on the ground, one of the first things he was consciously aware of was looking at her face and realizing she was not breathing. After that, he told himself to let go, but it seemed to take forever until he released her. At this point, the knife was on the floor by the fridge. He could not say the time involved, either how long the physical altercation took until her death, nor how long he laid on the ground when she was dead, and he was expecting the police would arrive, but they did not. The police also uncovered that strange cemented area in Alan and Lisa's basement. Encased in cement in a Rubbermaid tub covered in cat litter and soft water salt with air fresheners all over the place, they found her body. And they also found on Alan's laptop that in December of 2012, he had searched how body decomposition is affected by various things such as salt, lye, concrete, lack of air, and lack of insect activity. And in the spring of 2014, he had searched murder legislation in Canada. And an audio specialist was able to examine the voicemail that was left on Peggy's phone, and they found that on her phone he had installed this stalkerware, so he had used a bunch of calls that he had secretly recorded of her to clip them together into that voicemail, which explains why it sounded to Peggy as off. By the time the forensic pathologist was able to examine Lisa's remains, they were pretty badly decomposed. So he wasn't able to look at her skin or any layers of the fat or muscle. So he couldn't find any evidence on her neck of strangulation other than that the neck was fractured. Stating in his report, given the suspicious circumstances of her disappearance, in addition to how her body was found in the presence of neck trauma, it is felt that Miss Mitchell died as a result of probable manual strangulation. And in his confession to undercover cops, he discussed his option upon learning of the impending search of his home. And his new friend suggested one of the ways was getting a hold of a lawyer that's good enough to keep them from being able to search the house and having access to him, to which Alan said, and that's a 50-50 best shot, and added his option two was, I don't know, maybe scorch the house. but it would have to be more than scorched. I'd have to like bloated gas leak problem thing. So the officer slash friend said to that suggestion, it's a little dicey, a lot dicey, but it might give a guy at least a few months. And his friend says, so, you know, what's option three? And he said, I run. But he was arrested before he could run and charged with second degree murder in the death of Lisa Mitchell, his wife and mother to his two little kids, but was actually convicted of the lesser manslaughter charge and interfering with human remains. But the judge had some actually interesting things to say in his decision. I have no difficulty finding that Lisa Mitchell's unlawfully assaulted the accused. The actions of Lisa Mitchell to threaten or to injure the accused with a large chef knife and move toward him in a small kitchen space where he was boxed in was an unlawful assault. Lisa Mitchell had no lawful reason to do this. The Crown has not disproved this element. There is no evidence to suggest the assault by Lisa Mitchell was provoked. Thus, the Crown has not disproved that the assault was not provoked. It is the knife that makes the attack so threatening. The accused had no problem overpowering her. When the couple fell to the floor, she was overpowered. The confused evidence about a voice telling the accused to let go suggests that in some part of his consciousness, he was aware that the danger from the weapon was gone. There was nothing to suggest that he could not continue to overpower her by keeping her pinned down. The impression left from the description to the undercover operators is that the accused was subjectively aware of the lack of need to continue force to the neck, objectively considering the two were of equal height, close in weight, and had never exhibited fear of his ability to overpower her in the past, and that he had pinned her on the floor. Any continued force to her neck that caused death was excessive. As a result, I find that the Crown has disproved beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused used no more force than necessary. Thus, the defense of self-defense fails and is not available to the accused. If the accused had no concerns about the degree of force he had used and he was all sure that his actions were taken in self-defense, I have difficulty accepting that he, after reflection, in the hours after Lisa Mitchell's death, when he was lying beside her body, going to buy cigarettes and starting to clean up the body, would reject calling the police. Instead, he engaged in not only concealing the body, but for a period of days, continuing to react in a detailed and calculated manner to start and continue a fiction, even when realizing how complicated it was becoming. I have used the interference from the post-offense conduct to help interpret this very unclear statements to the undercover officers about what was in his mind. These do indicate some sense that he could and should let go in the circumstances. When I consider all of the evidence of the accused, the context of how the altercation between the accused and the victim started, the difficulty in establishing timing and the forensic evidence in relation to the fracture, I am left with a reasonable doubt as to the intention of the accused. It is not clear to me that he was able to form the intention necessary for second-degree murder. In the reactive situation in which he was put, and the evidence as to the short period of time that may have been required for death to occur, the evidence raises a reasonable doubt in my mind that the accused had the intention to kill Lisa Mitchell, or that he meant to cause bodily harm to Lisa Mitchell that he knew was likely to cause death. Now, the defense argued that not only was it self-defense, but that she had provoked him, and that is actually a legal defense. Section 232 of the Criminal Code says that a culpable homicide that otherwise would be murder may be reduced to manslaughter if the person who committed it did so in the heat of passion caused by sudden provocation. And provocation, under the sort of the legal term of that, is the type of, it's a wrongful act or insult that is sufficient to deprive an ordinary person of the power of self-control if the accused acted on it immediately and before there was time for his passion to cool. I did not find that the defense of provocation is available in this case. No description of events given by the accused of this event suggests that he acted in an emotional rage or heatedly in anger or with a loss of control in response to the words or actions of Lisa Mitchell. His evidence was clearly that it was the threat of the knife that made him act, not the result of rage that Lisa Mitchell suggested she could get custody of the children and he would not see them. Further, in the context of the relationship between these two people, this type of comment in the context of an argument that has been going on for over a two-day period would not be sudden or out of the ordinary or unexpected. The evidence at trial was that the two had a tumultuous relationship where verbal as well as physical arguments were ongoing. In conclusion, as a result of the reasoning above, I find the accused guilty of the lesser offense of manslaughter and guilty on count two of interference with her remains. And he was given a 7-year sentence on both counts. So 5 for the manslaughter and 2 for the indignity to human remains charge. But the Crown was not happy with this sentence. They felt that regardless of Lisa's actions, he went way too far, and his cold and calculated attempts to cover it up were very much aggravating factors, as was the fact that this was his wife. The only good thing that came out of this whole debacle was that Peggy received custody of the two children and has been raising them herself and preserving Lisa's memory for them. And the Alberta Court of Appeal agreed that his actions after the fact of leading Lisa's family to believe that she was alive made the original sentence unfit, but all they did was add a total of 3 years to the sentence and up the indignity charge to the maximum of 5 years. So now his sentence was 10 years. But of course, he had day parole after only a few years in 2018, but it was actually revoked in 2019 because he didn't bother mentioning to his parole officer that he had started a sexual relationship with a woman, which also included the massages that he would go for, and then he would have sex with the masseur. They also found sex toys in his halfway house bedroom, and his parole officer found that he had been hoarding his bipolar medication for over a month and not taking it. So the parole board said Mr. Schieback has not demonstrated enough sustained positive behavior to be manageable in any type of release into the community. Therefore, our recommendation today is to deny both day and full parole. And then, as life does to us, time marches on, and in April 2022, his sentence was done, and poof, he was back into the community. Peggy said, "My statement is basically, we do not care. He is not allowed to contact any family members. We have moved on and are remembering Lisa and good and happy memories, all of the fun times. We can't change anything. We are living well and enjoying life. We cherish every moment." And those family members that he cannot contact do include his two children, who are happy not to see or hear from him. And why do I say that all of this story was a lesson for all of us? Well, if you find yourself in a toxic relationship, you could be on either side of this story. You could be the one that finds your hands around someone's neck or pushing someone down a flight of stairs, or you could be the one that dies. So let's not be in toxic relationships, peeps. On either side of the story, these two kids didn't deserve to lose both their parents. And Lisa, even if she was hot-tempered, she didn't deserve to have the life crushed out of her windpipe. And here's the other lesson from Dave Sweet. Only I'm not exactly sure what the lesson is, but I think it's trust no one and everyone lies.
You know what? I've been tricked so many times. Years ago, I was involved in a case where I interviewed a guy, and I came out of the interview and I had said his girlfriend was missing. And I had said, well, I don't know. I don't think this guy has anything to do with this. We need to go back into her background again and start looking into some of these other things. And a year later, we were moving her body from a sarcophagus in a basement, you know, his basement. So it's, you know, for those that can say that they can absolutely tell, they're fooling themselves.
And that was the disappearance and murder of Lisa Mitchell. And I'm going to be back again next week with another case. You know what to do in the meantime. Do your rate review thing, tell your friends, all that good stuff. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.